A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Podcast Like It. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I'm your host, Phyllis Gove, and this is the very first episode of West Wing Wednesdays, where we will be talking about the pilot. We'll only be talking about the episodes that aired in 1999, so anyone who's expecting over 100 episodes of this will be sorely disappointed. But they will not be disappointed by the two amazing guests that we have for this pilot today. Alan Sepinwall, Chief TV Critic at Rolling Stone, and Emily Vanderwerf, Critic at Large at Vox and co-creator of Arden. I am so thrilled to talk with you guys about this. I know that you have perhaps a divisive opinion of this episode, perhaps of this series. I want to kind of preemptively just say, you know, that watching this show through the lens of 2021 is very different than it was maybe even before 2016. So I think that people's perspectives of the show probably has changed pretty dramatically as the political arena of this country has also shifted. So,
I mean, I think it's shifted for some people, but I know a lot of friends who spent the last 4 years like binging this show over and over again. As like some sort of, you know, antidepressant. So for some people, it still very much has that magic.
I'll say this. I did not rewatch the first season specifically because I knew that I was going to have this miniseries coming down the road. So I rewatched seasons 2 to the end in 2020 as some sort of a bomb of the election year and the various things that were going on. But I kind of want to rewind a little bit because I believe that you guys saw this show around the time that it aired. Were you watching it concurrently Was it, how did it come into your lives?
I was not. I watched it a couple years later on when it was on DVD. That's how I watched the first couple seasons. And then I started watching live right as it started to fall apart. So that may that may color my opinion on this show a little
sure,
bit. But
sure.
I watched the first season on DVD. The first season remains my favorite, though I think the pilot is one of its weaker episodes.
Alan?
And I'm an old man, so I was a TV critic at the time for a newspaper. Remember Newspapers Kids for the Star
no.
Ledger, New Jersey? And so not only did I review a bunch of episodes of the show, but I was at the first Television Critics Association press tour session for it, where a number of things were discussed that wound up making their way into the final version of this pilot. So we'll talk about that at some point, because the version that we've seen is not the version that I first saw.
Well, I mean, just to go behind the curtain a little bit for our listeners, as some people know, I'm sure the people certainly on this podcast know, pilots circulate around the industry as they're shot, then they change, there are reshoots, there are various things that come into play. And as we'll talk a little bit about in this particular episode, you know, a pilot is shot months and months and months before a series goes to air. So there can be changes of set design, costumes, various things. Even quite frankly, the voices of characters can change, and sometimes characters can outright disappear. So it's a process, especially on broadcast, more so than streaming or cable. So you saw this at the time, Alan.
Yes.
And I'm very curious, you know, similarly to Emily, I didn't watch this show live until season two. So for me, I also watched season one, I think, probably as it came out on DVD. This show was sort of a sensation from the jump, it felt like.
Yes.
And I'm sort of curious as to the reception that it got, why you think it got that reception, and how you imagine it would be received today if it was to premiere.
Well, I remember because I had been a big fan of Sorkin's first TV show, Sports Night, which he had also done with Tommy Shalhoub as the director. And that was not a perfect show, but it was really fun. And he obviously was a new voice to television. And sure. I'd seen a number of the movies that he'd written and really liked them. But like this felt a little bit different. And then he starts doing this pilot. And I remember watching and thinking, well, this is really fantastic. But where is the audience going to be for this? Because I had been brainwashed, like so many people, into accepting the company line that, like, audiences don't want to watch something overtly political, or if they do, they don't want to watch something with an overtly political message. And here is a show that, for the time, felt to me incredibly liberal. Like, just, you know, how dare they, like, say that he's a Democrat and, you know, be leaning to the left. No one's going to want to watch this. And even NBC seemed a little, you know, hedging its bets on it. And it wound up being a hit and talked about and, you know, an award winner from the start.
So, Emily, you didn't watch it live, but obviously you heard about it. Did you feel like did you wait consciously, or was this a show that sort of, and by that I mean, as we all know, the OG binge is the box set, right? There are a lot of people that kind of waited, you know, notoriously your Aliases, your 24s, your what have you, shows that found an audience later because the box sets helped them. Was this the case with you, or did you just sort of, was it not a show that you know, cared about?
I loved Sports Night. I watched Sports Night live. It hit me at a bad time in my schooling. I just was too busy to be watching a lot of television. And then when I was, you know, a little more, had a little breathing room, that's when I finally caught up. But I was always very interested in seeing it. I'm sure I caught a couple stray episodes because I've always been a big, like, Emmy follower. So I'm sure that I watched one or two episodes there. But you know, I was always a little bit bigger into Sopranos. Like, that was kind of a show that I made time for. And, you know, that was like the one show I had to fit in my schedule. That and Buffy,
sure.
I was watching, and then everything else kind of fell by the wayside. And those were already established in my life. So, like, I stopped watching X-Files at that time, and I wrote a book about the X-Files.
So, so I want to just, I'm going to very quickly give a synopsis and a little bit of context, and then I want to dive into, you know, this pilot and perhaps the toxic effects this show might have had on democracy.
Oh boy.
The
buckle up,
the senior,
kids.
The senior staff is called back to the White House as POTUS, quote unquote, President of the United States. Jed Bartlett is injured, having ridden his bicycle into a tree. Josh Lyman, the deputy chief of staff, is in trouble after a television appearance in which he makes an insulting comment to a representative of a politically connected Christian group. And Sam Seaborn, the deputy director of communications, spends a night with a woman who turns out to be a prostitute. Another subplot is 1,200 Cuban boat refugees, 137 of whom arrive in Miami and request asylum, while 350 are missing in a storm and presumed dead. The pilot of The West Wing aired on September 22nd, 1999. It was written by Aaron Sorkin, directed by Tommy Schlamme. It garnered just shy of 17 million viewers, which is pretty crazy to think about. The first season received 18 Emmy Awards for the 52nd Primetime Emmy Awards. Best drama series, best supporting actor, best supporting actress, best writing in a drama series for Aaron Sorkin and Rick Cleveland in the somewhat infamous In Excelsis Deo. Outstanding directing for a drama series, Tommy Schlamme, main title sequence, and a bunch of others. I want to just kind of dive in because obviously we don't have you forever and we could talk about this probably for many hours, but I want to sort of dive into the thick of it, which is that there are a lot of people, some perhaps even on this podcast, that believe that this television show and perhaps this pilot started something. And by that, meaning a sort of idyllic, unrealistic expectations of how politics are supposed to go. And I guess my question to both of you is that the show's fault?
I'm pushing my chair back. Emily, this is you, girl. Take it.
Emily's written many articles about this. So let's tear off the Band-Aid. Let's do it.
No and yes. I think it is a little silly to suggest, as we have in the last year, that the many, 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 many cop dramas that have influenced the way we think about the police.
Aren't
is happening. Sure. And yet something like The West Wing did not influence how we think about politics, mm-hmm. As big of a show as it was and as groundbreaking of a show as it was. And I'm not saying anything against the show when I say that, because I do really enjoy this show. I find it tremendous comfort food television. I am a white woman in her 30s or 40s, and the Aaron Sorkin dialogue is just like a soothing balm to my brain, and I don't think that is the show's fault. I think that Aaron Sorkin's view of how political discussions should work has very much fallen out of favor. I don't know that that was out of favor in 1999, which is an important context to place on it. Absolutely. On the other hand, I think this show makes absolutely no effort to understand how political opposition works. The Republicans within its universe make no sense as characters, and it has created an unrealistic sense of that, which I think has filtered out to how the Democratic Party does a lot of things and how mainstream Democrats, not so much the left, more leftist forces that are sort of really trying to change the party, either from within or without, how they think about how political opposition functions. And like that has paralyzed the party for quite some time. I'm not here to litigate the failures of American democracy, but one party, like a bunch of people literally tried to overthrow the Capitol this year. Like, how do you write that into The West Wing? You can't. Like,
well, that's the thing. Everything about this show, and Alan, obviously I want to hear your thoughts about the shortcomings of this show or this pilot, perhaps as well. But I do think that the show feels downright quaint now, right? Mm-hmm. Like when you think about the crisis at the center of this pilot, it's that Josh made a overly articulate insult that I imagine most of the audience didn't even understand about tax fraud towards a religious individual. It wouldn't even make the news. I mean, I'm not sure anybody would even care.
The idea of anyone in politics at this point losing their job because of any gaffe, let alone one this relatively mild, this feels like from a million years ago. It's so, not naive, because I imagine this sort of thing might have happened back then, but compared to what the last 4 years of America have done to accountability or the lack thereof, you know, Josh would just double down and tell everyone to, you know, go bleep themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I also want to fold in for a second here another Aaron Sorkin show, which is Studio 60. And I bring that up because...
Don't say anything nice about Studio 60, Emily.
Well, I don't think it's going to be anything nice. But I think that there's this... As we all know, Aaron Sorkin lives in a bubble, right? Like, he lives in this sort of...
Yes.
This perception of the world. And one of those perceptions is the fame of people that, quite frankly, are not famous. This idea that that some people would go up to Josh and ask for his autograph, to me, seems kind of laughable. It's similar to when Matt and Danny are outside the Studio 60 and there's a flood of people asking for their autographs. I guarantee you that the showrunners of sketch comedy shows do not have people asking for their autographs. I think that Aaron Sorkin puts these people on pedestals, which is completely fair, but he thinks everybody does. And I think that that's sort of a misconception on his part. But Alan, I want to dive into your feelings about the pilot and perhaps about the series and what shortcomings you think it might have or strengths.
Well, it was very weird watching this because I loved this show once upon a time, you know, when Matt Seitz and I, we did the TV book, we ranked it fairly highly. Although I know a bunch of people at the time felt like we were too harsh on it. Like, I think it's very important. It's sort of the last of the real classical great broadcast network dramas that was aiming for something big in this way. But Sorkin's done a lot of things since then, including a show we have just brought up, Studio 60. He's done The Newsroom, the Chicago 7 movie, all of these. And it's like, it's so hard for me to now look at this show and not be seeing and hearing it through the lens of all the other stuff he's done and things that I found charming at the time, I now just want to like yell at people about, you know, like
for
I
sure,
thought,
for sure.
You know, like, you know, Toby, like telling off the flight attendant when Toby is introduced and rattling off all the details about the flight control system and how his phone can't mess with it. At the time, it's a great introduction. Now he just seems like, you know, the atypical smug Sorkin character, but everybody does. Like, other than Sam and CJ and Leo, I guess in Bartlett when he comes in at the end, but like I really did not like Toby in this episode. I really did not like Josh in this episode. Nobody ever liked Mandy, but she seems even worse now, sort of.
Hey, for
sure. Look through the lens. Are you going to defend Mandy, Emily?
No, I was just like, I remember when I said at the start that the first season was my favorite. Can you imagine it was because of the one with Mandy? And I was like, yay, my favorite. No, Mandy's, I don't hate Mandy like a lot of people, but she's a character that never had a reason to exist. Go
she
on,
just
Alan.
Never.
No,
never
and as Phil notes, shows, sometimes characters disappear. For Mandy, it just wasn't after the pilot. It was around mid-season where that happened. Just like there's a lot of devices. The characters constantly rattling off their resumes, explaining things. Even something like CJ doing the pratfall off of the treadmill.
Introduction, yeah.
Yes. Alison Janney, great at slapstick, wonderful, but now like I just only see it as all Sorkin heroines are ultimately clowns. And the first time we're seeing her, what does she do? She falls.
I couldn't agree with you more. I just sort of want to talk about premise pilot versus throwing you in the deep end. Because I think that this show does something that probably wouldn't happen on broadcast right now. The idea of basically saying like, here are the characters, here's the universe. You're a year and a half into your first term. Just buckle up and figure it out. Mm-hmm. Do you guys think that, I mean, that's kind of a Sorkin trope now, I guess, for all intents and purposes, but how do you think that that affected the love for the show, or how it affected the way people watched it? I mean, do you think that it's that boldness, do you give credit to that? Do you appreciate that about it?
I do. I mean, that's also oddly, even though he didn't really run the show until the fifth season, it's also a John Wells thing, because if you watch the ER pilot, it's the same thing. Like, obviously you're getting John Carter's first day, but mostly it's just, here's a bunch of people who've worked together forever. You'll have to figure out the terminology as you go. And like nowadays, you're absolutely right. A show today would make it. It's their first day. It's inauguration day. Maybe they would even make the whole first season the campaign. I mean, certainly if it was right. a Netflix show, the whole first season right. would be the campaign. Then they actually are, you know, the presidential administration.
Alan, if this was a Netflix show, the whole first season would be Bartlett being born. We would see his first year of life. And then like somewhere in the finale, you'd be like, this guy's going to be president in 60 years. You'd be like, yes, great.
But definitely one of the sort of hallmarks of the Sorkin Shlami style is we're going to throw you into the deep end and trust that you can swim. And that part I do like, because it's origin stories are almost never as interesting as stories of the characters just being together. There are very few premise pilots that are ever remotely as good as the show that followed. Just give me what the show is, and the West Wing does that.
I would also say, too, that it makes the premiere of season two so much more powerful because you love these people and you know these people. So getting to see how the Bartlett campaign came together and how all the pieces came together of this team that you've grown to love over 22 episodes, I think is, you know, a stroke of brilliance to some degree. I think it's interesting that the stakes of this episode, truly the stakes of the pilot episode, are, is Josh going to get fired? Who is someone that I don't even know, right? Like 10 minutes into this pilot, everyone's just like, is Josh going to get fired? I mean, 10 minutes. The first scene is about this reporter talking to Sam saying, like, is Josh going to get fired?
Yep.
That's kind of insane. Like it's at least by the standards that we live in today, right? Where you're just like, I know that I'm being told that this is important, but the fact that I really actually do care about 10 minutes into this episode when I meet Josh, when I see who he is, and talk about just putting a lot on the shoulders of Bradley Whitford to make that character as likable as he is almost immediately.
Yeah. I think one of the things I remember about this is that back when the show debuted, there were like all of these like, The West Wing became a hit. So a lot of like magazines or whatever wrote about it. And I read probably an Entertainment Weekly feature, because that was the magazine I read, about why this show was so beloved. And they were like, it gets you into the jargon. Did you know that POTUS means President of the United States? Like the degree to which people didn't know about the behind the scenes of the White House at that time, even though the Clinton administration, like people did know the names of those various, head speechwriter or whatever,
sure.
Which is the thing that's carried through from then, even when you're in a Republican administration, like we knew all of the Donald Trump underlings, just intimately, which is a thing that I'm glad to no longer have to do. But yeah, I think that this show is really relying on you transferring your feelings about the Clinton White House onto what's happening on screen, a thing that grows more and more difficult, that grew more and more difficult literally in 2001. Like, yeah. And the further we get from that, because, you know, you're supposed to be like, oh, that's the George Stephanopoulos. I'm like, I don't remember what George Stephanopoulos did. I just know he was there. So
I think he was the Sam Seaborn character. He was the deputy mm-hmm. communications director. But to your point, Emily, I think it is interesting that like the sting at the end of the cold open is the reveal that POTUS means President of the United States. Like,
yeah.
Like it's literally like, ta-da. And it's adorable now to think that that's something that tell your friend POTUS, he has a silly name. Yeah. I do think that this show does, and I mean, I haven't done, outside of Felicity, I haven't talked that much about, Emily and I talked about Felicity a little bit too, that much broadcast television in 99. And watching this, both of you, maybe more specifically Alan, I'm curious as to sort of how this show compared to the things around it. Like, watching it now, it feels very broadcast to me. And I mean that in a good way. It's very comforting. But did this, I mean, obviously it won all these Emmys and what have you, but did this stand out? Did this feel drastically dissimilar to the things around it?
Well, it's funny because it debuted, I think, 3 days apart from the Freaks and Geeks pilot, which we've talked about, Phil, as well.
Yes.
So sort of it's sort of two ships passing in the night. On the one hand, you have West Wing, which felt like a lot on broadcast, but felt like a better version of it. Like there's certain stylistic quirks that you'd already seen on some of the glossier dramas, like ER, for instance.
Sure.
But this was just sort of even more polished. The stakes are obviously much higher because it's taking place in the White House. The score is swelling, although it's very weird to hear the score in this pilot because they don't have the theme down yet. This sounds like the score to Dave.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
I think they literally, that's the White House set that they use. They use the set from Dave and not the set from the American president, even though that's the one that Sorkin wrote where he has like sort of beta versions of all of these characters. But like it just, in terms of the level of execution, the production values and all of that, this was about as good as it was getting at the time in broadcast. And in the years that followed, broadcast started to change and go a little bit more niche, or in certain cases, go a little bit more cinema verite, you know, or start aping like what the CSI shows were doing, you know, in terms of photography. But this was like the culmination of 50 years of TV drama.
This is like the last of the big 80s workplace dramas. Obviously, it debuted in 1999, but there's this movement in the 80s that starts with Hill Street Blues, continues through St. Elsewhere, etc., that is like, we are going to go into a workplace and show you the people there and show you their lives and show you how it functions. And that kind of dies off in the early 2000s when CSI is an out-of-nowhere monster hit, and everyone's like, we're going to copy that. And then Lost, a few years later, is an out-of-nowhere monster hit. People are like, we're going to copy that. People have kind of tried to do shows like this since, but like the only one that's really stuck in terms of becoming a phenomenon was Grey's Anatomy. And that was very soapy. Like, that was not quite on tone with the other stuff that had happened. So if nothing else, like, I am impressed with this being that form of show that sort of has fallen away and that I find very comforting. I could watch ER, like, all day long.
Well, it feels like, and you brought it up, both of you brought it up, but, you know, one of the things that I love about 99 is the premiere of The West Wing and the premiere of The Sopranos, right? This is the fork in the road for television, right? Like, this is the moment when you see... Now, that's not to say West Wing wins Best Drama at the Emmys for 40 years, and it's obviously a titan of... But it is the last truly great, it feels like, broadcast drama that really kind of ran the board. But The Sopranos is the future, right? I mean, The Sopranos is where it's all going.
Yeah.
And, you know, you mentioned the workplace. The family becomes the next thing, right? Like, in cable, it feels like the family show, the dysfunctional family, the family business show, the what have you. It does feel like The Sopranos starts that sort of trend.
But it's also the good guy versus the anti-hero. Yes. Like, these are, like, the most noble public servants imaginable. And then they're going up against Tony Soprano. And it feels like... the Emmy thing, the fact that it took until the fifth season for Sopranos to win Best Drama over West Wing was as much about like what the industry wanted to say about itself and its image as it was about the idea of the entrenched broadcast old guard saying, we're not going to vote for this grubby cable show. We are still where it's at.
The goofiest thing about the Sopranos Emmy run is that it lost the first season. Everyone was like, well, the first season's going to win because it's so groundbreaking. And it won like writing. It won the two actors. It won for Falco, not Gandolfini. He didn't win that season. And then it loses to The Practice. And you're like, The Practice was a good show, but who the fuck thinks about The Practice anymore? You know?
I was just thinking about that because I realized, like, wait a minute, Sopranos is January of 99, so that first season did not go up against West Wing. No. And I couldn't remember which David E. Kelly show it was, but oh, God.
It's because you never think about The Practice, but you have to. You got to start thinking about it.
Sure. I mean, the fact that, I mean, David E. Kelly, obviously just a titan at the time. The amount of episodes he has his name on is just unreal. In 99 alone, it's just incredible. But
That's what happens when you don't write second drafts.
Yep.
Wow. I have no idea.
I want to just very quickly talk about what you were talking about, Alan, in terms of the visual language that's set up. This is also probably one of the early attempts at a cinematic looking television show. I mean, this show is very sort of Robert Richardson-esque, a lot of hot lighting, a lot of sort of very obviously the walk and talks, the long takes, the very sort of like fluid kind of almost theatrical component of it, I think is another thing that made this show stand out. I don't think that anyone had seen any. I mean, ER does that in terms of lots of Steadicam shots and what have you. But it's also, I don't know, it's visceral in a different way. This feels like it's just sort of, it's a dance, whereas ER feels like it's an action sequence.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Shlomi and Sorkin had been doing their walk and talks on Sports Night. Yeah. So like, it's not like they're brand new here, but certainly this is when they start to feel like, oh, TV can do this. Because you've seen it in the movies before, yeah. But yeah. The West Wing figures out a way to do it, not just on a TV budget, but 22 times a season. Yeah. And like that's really impressive. Obviously, like when we talk about cinematic television, a term I kind of hate using, but one that everybody has sort of decided we should. You know, obviously The Sopranos is also a big part of that, but The Sopranos is a bit more traditionally filmed. It just is much more like the cinematic qualities of it, you kind of have to be super steeped in TV to understand. Whereas with this, you see those walk and talks and you're like, oh my God, that's so impressive. They're showy, you know?
Yeah. I know that Alan in particular loves the notion of the 10-episode movie. I think that's one of his favorite.
Oh, right. I'm sorry, you're breaking up.
So West Wing Origins on Netflix is a 10-episode movie about Baby Bartlett.
Baby Bartlett. Oh, my God. That sounds terrible.
I'm in such pain right now.
I do want to sort of I want to dive into what the storyline or the plot line that I had the biggest issue with, which is Sam's. I don't love the Lori, the prostitute with the heart of gold, who's trying to become a lawyer, is also a part-time bartender, and he accidentally slept with and found out she was a prostitute because they swapped beepers. These are all, like, all of this just feels insane to me, but,
go ahead, Alan.
But also, it's Rob Lowe,
who
had been involved in a sex scandal, like, not too long before.
It is one of the things that I think marks Sorkin's quality as a writer is that you're watching one of these things and you just kind of go with it. And then someone describes to you the plot and you're like, what the hell is happening?
But also, like, keep in mind, this was the same year, because this was season two of Sports Night. He was writing concurrently with this, where Jeremy, like, has an affair with a porn actress who he's too ashamed to tell people does porn, and so he tells them she is a choreo animator. So, like, clearly he had this on the brain, like, you know, put his sort of, like, slightly rumpled, fumbling, Hugh Grant-esque, you know, writing young geniuses in with a sex worker.
Yeah, it does feel like, and I don't know if this is a commentary on sort of the puritanical stuff that exists in America and Sorkin trying to kind of, you know, poke at these taboos, or if this is just Sorkin being like, I don't know, it's the sex trade is interesting. It's exciting. As we all know, because we've all seen the clips of all the various Sorkinisms, the man goes back to the well a lot. And sometimes I get the impression that he's just like, I don't know, prostitute. Like, so, you know what I mean? It's like he just kind of pulls things out of hats. Because I just feel like he knows, he's even said this himself, and I don't say this as a denigrating thing, but to him, the words almost don't matter. It's the mellifluous kind of quality that they have. It's like it's like music to him. So he's just slotting in things that sound good to him. And that's not necessarily the best way to write, but
but it's like, it's an interesting way to put it, because I'm someone who a lot of the time I don't think about the lyrics to the songs I'm listening to. I will play stuff in the car with my kids that I've heard a million times, and one of them will say, Dad, what is this song about? And I have to start listening. I'm like, oh my God, like, it just doesn't occur to me. And I know there's definitely people who the rhythm of the Sorkin writing is so soothing to them and so appealing, and I get that. It's the same way with Amy Sherman-Palladino and some other writers who have this very, like, idiosyncratic rhythm to the way that the dialogue comes.
Totally.
Alan, if you've been jamming out to Dude Looks Like a Lady without thinking about it, you're going to have words.
It was not Aerosmith, I can say that much.
I want to talk for a second about just because it's worth talking about.
Hold on. Before we move on from the Lisa Edelstein story, the other thing that's odd about it is, like, the show was originally designed, and you could tell from watching this, it's the Sam Seaborn show. Mm-hmm. Jed Bartlett was not supposed to be the main character. There's even a version Sorkin has talked about where you never see the president. It's the, you know, I want to hold your hand, the Robert Zemeckis movie version, where Bartlett, like, you see his shoes as he's, like, leaving a room or something. And that's about it.
Like the mother from How I Met Your Mother.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. And then, like, they hired Sheen, and it was going to be a small role, and he comes in, and he walks in saying, I'm the Lord your God, you shall have no gods before me. Yeah. And immediately he takes over the show, and it transforms very quickly. But, like, this was meant to be a Rob Lowe vehicle. And think about the fact that, like, if this is meant to be a Rob Lowe vehicle, he is starting the show off with Sam Seaborn accidentally sleeping with a sex worker.
With oddly gray hair, too. Did you notice that he has, like, flecks of gray in his hair, too? Like, there's choices with Sam's character in this pilot that are strange. It also speaks to the somewhat strained relationship, it sounds like, that existed with Rob Lowe and this show, which is that he was pitched, I'm assuming, the Rob Lowe show, and then all of a sudden it became a big ensemble, and I don't know how much he liked that. You know, there's lots of talk about, you know, renegotiations of contracts when the show was a hit, and various cast members taking cuts in pay, and Rob Lowe saying, I'm good. things that feel like Rob Lowe never stopped thinking that this was the Rob Lowe show.
Rob Lowe always submits himself as a lead actor on any show he is on, no matter the size of the role.
Yes. I want to talk for a second about, you mentioned the Bartlett Muppet Babies version where we only see the socks, you know, like the version. They did apparently approach Alan Alda at one point as an original candidate for Bartlett, as well as Sidney Poitier and Jason Robards, all of which would have been quite interesting. I mean, I can't obviously see anyone other than Martin Sheen. The one casting thing that continues to feel like the sliding doors version of this show was that Eugene Levy was the second choice for Toby Ziegler. That's fascinating to me. I don't know quite what that is. Richard Schiff has talked about how his, let's say, curmudgeonly components as a human, I think, bled into Toby Ziegler, and obviously the character was sort of curtailed towards his strengths. I don't know what the Eugene Levy comedic version of Toby Ziegler looks like, but it's...
Can you imagine Eugene Levy getting cast in this? And then that summer, he also has done American Pie. So at the TCA panel, the first TCA panel for West Wing, there are a million questions about fucking a pie. What does Aaron Sorkin make of that?
But see, on the one hand, it threw me when you said that, Phil, but then I started thinking back to American President. And again, all of the characters in the show, Sorkin had already written in that movie. So Martin Sheen is playing Leo in American President. Anna Deavere Smith is playing CJ, et cetera. They just have different names. So the Toby character in that movie is played by David Paymer. So, like, you know, who is a comedic actor who has also done drama and certainly done more drama than Eugene Levy. But, like, it's not hard to envision, like, here's another Jewy funny man, you know, with sort of a Borscht Belt sensibility. We will put him in here and we will do this.
You know, it's, you bring up the American President, which I think is obviously incredibly important because it is the sort of the early version of this show, right? If anyone who has watched the American President, you can obviously see the direct correlation between these two shows. But it also speaks to the fluidity of the pilot process that we talked about up top. This idea of a television show is an organism, it's an evolving thing that you kind of have to just hold on tight because it's a train that leaves the station and you can't really fight it. And you pick the right people, hopefully, and you get the right cast, and then you work to the strengths of these actors and you try to, you know, obviously do the best job that you can. But I do think that this pilot's a perfect example of, it's not one of my favorite episodes of this show for all the reasons that we're talking about, because it doesn't totally know what it is yet. It's still a much better pilot than most. I think we can safely say that just in its DNA, some of the choices that were made and what have you are bold and most of them stick the landing. But, like, Toby's voice is weird. CJ's falling on all this stuff that you're just like, I don't really like this stuff. And then the show kind of finds its sea legs, and I think it starts to work. Would you guys agree that in series, the show really starts to find its voice in a way that feels a little bit more solidified?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot.
we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
No, ask me that question again, because I got okay. I disagree. Do you feel like, but
no, but I that's fair. Do you feel like, because I watching this pilot yesterday for the first time in a little while, I did find myself just really seeing the pilot-itis in it, and I guess my question is, I do feel like the show, personally speaking, I think season two is my favorite season of the show, but I do think that it really starts to gel when Mandy starts to get shown the door and they start to really understand who this show's about.
Yeah. Yes, it's about the men. That's great.
What about men, not, Emily? Yeah. What happened to men? Give me some more men, please.
And CJ. And CJ.
CJ, yes. That was the original title.
And Josh, when he's flirting with Mandy at the coffee shop, keeps like referring to her boyfriend as like a woman or at least a feminine. So that has not been great.
There was a quote from Sorkin where he said that his wife said, don't write that. It's homophobic. And he still did it.
I am always fascinated when Aaron Sorkin was winning awards for Trial of the Chicago 7. He kept talking about his daughter wanting to be a filmmaker. So I looked up her films and they're all really fucking good, but they're also like cinema verite documentaries. It's just like, how far can I get away? Like one of them is just like, one of them is about breastfeeding. And I'm like, what is the least Aaron Sorkin project you can possibly imagine? I think that this show really starts to gel a couple episodes into season one. Yeah. Adding Charlie, which I'm sure maybe Alan will talk about, was a response to complaints about the pilot. Yes. Charlie's never the show's best character, but he comes in and they're like, we have to introduce you to everyone. So they basically do a premise pilot in episode two, which is weirdly like a successful choice. By the middle of season one, I feel like this show is really firing on all cylinders. And like, again, I said I like season one best, and I agree that Mandy is like a big sore spot. But season one is when they don't know they're an important show, and they're still able to like get away with kind of goofy, interesting things without like trying to underscore the grandiosity of everything. And by season two, my hottest West Wing take is that I don't like Two Cathedrals, but we don't have to talk about that right now. Season two just starts to go over the top in a way that really bugs me.
It's when the drugs start to really kick in.
Yeah.
I'll say this. I think that season two was the first season of television that I actually felt like as a viewer, I could see from 30,000 feet and could see the whole thing as a piece, as a thing unto itself, in a way that I had never kind of done before. I was probably, I don't know, 19 or 20 at the time. But like, I think what I appreciate about it is that it does feel like a full circle unto itself, which I don't know that I had ever seen before. So I have a soft spot for it in that regard. But I want to kind of talk for a second about the character entanglements, the lack of romance on this show in a lot of ways. I think that it doesn't sort of, it's not really a show about the personal lives of these characters. It's about sort of how those personal lives intersect with their work lives and all that sort of stuff. I'm bringing it up because of the Mallory and Sam scene in the pilot. Leo's daughter Mallory brings her class to the West Wing. Sam is supposed to give them a tour, and Sam, you know, accidentally tells her that that he slept with a prostitute the night before. And then we get like goofy music as we go to a commercial. It's not great. So I wanted to highlight for a second here that the Mandy and Josh thing was they dated in the past and they've been brought back together in the West Wing. And I think it's interesting that the Donna component is what ultimately sort of thwarts the Mandy relationship with Josh. And I bring this up because it's kind of tropey. It's a thing that Sorkin does, which is workplace drama where a couple that used to be a couple are forced back together again. How do you guys feel about that trope?
It's fine. You know,
right.
It comes up a lot. The first time I ever wrote a pilot that got like any heat, look at this, me who's never actually sold a television show talking about like things having heat was about that exact concept. Like, I think it is a thing that I think people are inherently interested in, is like couples being forced to work together. To actually grab from my own personal life, a big thing that like saved my marriage with my wife was we started a podcast together back when our marriage was really flailing. You can't access that podcast anymore because we took it off the internet for very good reasons. But like,
we scrubbed it from the world.
We scrubbed it from the world. But like, yeah, it is an inherently compelling dramatic format. And I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, West Wing pursuing that. They just didn't have a great, like, Aaron Sorkin should not write this because he really can't write women.
No.
He's not great at it. Even if I do think that I adore CJ as a character, and I think that a lot of the heavy lifting is being done by Allison Janney, who's a tremendous actor. But I do think he's not great at writing women. I don't know.
And actually, thinking about this, like the comedy of remarriage, two spouses being forced to work together is a core tenet of Screwball. And Sorkin clearly is like into writing Screwball, so I get why he would go to that well. But yeah, again, I think that just the writing of women, despite he's worked with some great actresses like Allison Janney and Felicity Huffman and so on, but the writing of women has plagued him throughout his career.
And Jessica Chastain.
Yeah, it's funny what you mentioned about Donna, though, because I always enjoy when that happens, where a show clearly has a relationship endgame in mind. And like some, like nobody, it's like the Truman Show where he falls in love with the woman who's not Laura Linney, you know, and they have to kick
Natasha
her out.
McClough, yeah.
Yes, exactly. So like this happened on Arrow with Felicity, who was meant to be like a one episode character and like takes over the show. It's always kind of cool when like the show like fights back against what the creators want to do, or in some cases, what the audience fighting back up against what the creators want to do.
I totally agree with you. Janelle Maloney said something really beautiful about John Spencer, which is when they were shooting the pilot, Donna's first line is Leo goes up to her and says, "Can you get Josh for me?" And she screams Josh like over her shoulder. And Leo says, "I could have done that." So they did that line. They did a couple takes of it. And John Spencer turned to her and said, "You're going to be here until the curtain comes down." Like he just recognized that there was something about her and what she was bringing to the. And I think that I'm with you. This comes back to sort of what we've been talking about. What I love about television is that something like that can happen, right? That you can find this thing and be like, oh, this is great. Like this thing we thought we wanted isn't as great. And it takes great producers and great writers to recognize that, because a lot of people force things. A lot of showrunners are determined to make sure that this thing that they want sticks. And I appreciate that they didn't do that. I want to talk for a second about the end of the episode, which is everything kind of works out for the most part. Jed is unreasonable towards these religious, right-wing religious people that are in his White House. He says, "Get your fat asses out of my White House," which feels like a bit much. But at the very, very end, we get sort of what will become a classic West Wing moment. We're in the Oval Office and Jeb is basically talking about the Cubans that tried to come into the country. Maybe I'm an idealist. I'm certainly a sentimentalist. Whenever I get a speech from Martin Sheen on this show, I either cry or get goosebumps. I think that it's beautiful writing. The music is swelling. There's this, the potential of this country. And it just, and I know I'm an immigrant myself, even if it's just from Canada, but I do think that this country has so much potential. And this show taps into that. And I guess that's what's lovely about it. But I'm curious as to sort of what you guys felt about the crescendo of this episode.
I hate it. No, I don't hate it. I love you, Emily. The end of it's fine. Like, but what really bugs me is that scene with the religious leaders. I think that is everything wrong about Aaron Sorkin and the modern mainstream left, if you will, in one scene. You know, it is. When I was rewatching this, I was like, this scene has always bugged me, but now it's crystallized for me. What's wrong with his approach? And I'll talk more about that in a second, because I will go off for 5 minutes.
I consciously left that to the end for us to unpack that specific portion of it.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about with the guy who doesn't know what the commandments are.
Just to very briefly, when the show debuted, I was living in South Dakota among religious conservatives. I was sort of breaking my own religious conservatism and like realizing I was further left leaning than I thought I was and all of these other things. Sure. When literally I met a gay person was like, oh, interesting. But that scene bugged a lot of people in my life who otherwise would have liked this show, because the character is so self-consciously a buffoon and doesn't know things anyone who's been to a Christian church would know. Like, you have a vague sense of what the commandments are, unless like you were going to have Bartlett and this guy get in a weird doctrinal difference about like where you split the commandments, which is a thing they could have done. Like, but I don't think we want to see people having a denominational argument on broadcast television. But the problem with Sorkin and the problem a lot of times with Democrats that I think is in, I can't figure out if this is inherent to the way mainstream Democrats conceptualize the universe, or if Aaron Sorkin introduced this idea like a mind virus, is that everybody behaves the way that a mainstream Democrat does. That if you bring in the evidence, and if you bring in like the receipts, and if you come in and you speak it with passion and you say, this is what's true, everyone will be so awed and so cowed by you that they'll just sort of back down. I lived through the presidency of Barack Obama. He is the most gifted political orator of my lifetime. And like, he would give a great speech and nothing would happen, because that's just not how the world works. And Aaron Sorkin's world, you cannot account for that. And I think that is the show's biggest flaw politically, but it's also its biggest flaw, like in terms of art, because like there aren't interesting antagonists in this show. There's just kind of people who like fall over when Bartlett says boo. And it holds the show back, but I think it's also introduced this kind of terrible idea into our political conversation that has taken over much of the left to the degree that we are now in this place where, like, you know, I am a Democrat. I tend to vote for Democrats, but like when I vote, but like the situation that is presented in this pilot is so far from the one in our world. And it largely stems from people not even attempting to understand where the other side is coming from, and not in the sense of like we all need to get together and talk, but in the sense of like their strategies are so different and the ways in which you defeat those strategies are so different from what you think they are. Mm-hmm. And like, I agree with basically nothing that's happening on the right now, but I do think that back in 1999 there could have been an attempt to like create a dialogue that we just can't do now. And I think that this show kind of failed in that regard. And I think that's one of its biggest struggles, because you don't see sympathetic cultural portrayals of people from red states. And that's a tricky thing to do right now, because you see how much of that is driven by various prejudices and so on and so forth, the really extreme right-wing stuff. Mm-hmm. But like, culturally speaking, when we look at our pop culture, it's all about people who live in basically blue havens. And like, mm-hmm. I don't know, if I were living in a red state, even with my same politics, I'd be a little annoyed by that.
I think that this show definitely tried to bring Republican characters into the show. But to your point, Emily, they weren't as... I mean, I liked Ainsley Hayes. I appreciated her character. Mm-hmm. I liked Emily Proctor's performance. But I absolutely hear where you're coming from. Alan, you look like you had something to say.
Well, it's interesting, because the original version of the pilot... that scene is even worse. Not so much because of that scene. The scene is exactly the same in the version that was like, you know, shown before TCA and everything else. But the earlier scene where Leo and Al Caldwell are walking on the street outside the White House did not exist. So, really? Like, yes. So all you see is you see Josh on Capitol Beat, you know, telling off Mary Marsh. And then you see the three of them in there. So even though we've been told Al Caldwell is a good man, in the scene, he mainly seems like an empty suit and sort of, you know, toothless and all that. And then he's sitting next to the moron who doesn't know what the commandments are, so he can be the straw man that Bartlett knocks down when he walks in.
Right.
And I remember at that TCA panel, Sorkin got beat up, obviously, for the all-white cast, and that's what led to Charlie coming in. He got beat up for Mandy saying, you know, I would bitch slap you across the beltway, whatever the line is. Although, oddly, not for the homophobic, you know, misogynistic stuff that Josh says in the same scene, because people are weird. but also, people brought up the religious conservative scene and saying, like, look, there are definitely bad people on that side, but they just all seem so cartoonish and weak. And Sorkin, you could sort of see him, the light bulb going off as he was talking. And like, clearly they were going to go back to DC to do a little more location shooting. And he wrote that. And so as a result, you go in and you think of Al Caldwell. Oh, he's Leo's buddy. He's at least like somewhat decent, even though he's working with these bad people. Whereas in the original version, he's just nobody, and the Republicans, the religious right people, are all just cartoonishly evil across the board.
You know, it's... I didn't like this scene. I didn't like this scene for a bunch of reasons. It's not particularly subtle. It's clearly grappling with a lot of stuff that it... I mean, there's a quote here I'm going to read from an article in the New York Post from July 31st, 99, where Sorkin said, "It wasn't my intention to paint the entire religious right with one brush. On the other hand, I admit that there are moments when I take a personal passion of mine and get up on a box and let you know about it." That's one way of putting it. He's being kind to himself. But, I think that this show, this sort of comes full circle to what we were talking about up top, which is that, you know, this show couldn't exist today. We've had political dramas since. We've had Scandal. We've had House of Cards. We've had various political shows that have come up over the years. And they're all kind of dinged with being either too soapy or not particularly political and what have you. This show really does put politics at the forefront. I'd say both those other shows, Scandal and House of Cards, are really more soap operas than they are political dramas. This show wears its politics on its sleeve for good or for bad. And I think that scene crystallizes it. It's not a subtle scene. It runs into anti-Semitism as well, just because it feels like Sorkin feels like he needs to, you know, comment on that in some way or another. It's just not great. It's not a great scene. The best part of the scene, if you ask me, is when Bartlett comes in with this booming commandment, which is just crazy to think about at the time, but it's a hell of an entrance. And
it's one of the great entrance lines any character has ever had in television.
What could you ask for? And then, of course, like, the dials during the test went through the roof, and they were like, well, I guess we got to pay Martin Sheen $1 billion to be on this show. No one can be surprised by that. But I guess to sort of really kind of come to full circle and wrap this up to some degree, I want to kind of ask about the Bartlett character, because we talked about how Bartlett wasn't supposed to be a main part of the show. He was just supposed to be sort of a sprinkling, or he'd have one scene at the end. And essentially, it seems like, do this every week, which he would show up at the end of every episode, give a big speech and leave. And by turning Bartlett into a full-fledged character, the show really becomes not just an ensemble, but Bartlett sort of at the top of the food chain. What are your thoughts about Bartlett as a character? I mean, he's a man. Martin Sheen is a person who grapples with his religious, with his, you know, his feelings about religion. It's very much a part of Bartlett's character, which he made clear to Sorkin that he wanted that to be a part of him. How do you feel about sort of the push and pull within this character of being this sort of liberal who apparently isn't totally against or for abortion? I mean, there's just a lot of stuff kind of wrestling inside this character.
It's fun to think of him through the lens of like Arnie Vinnick, who Alan Alda did ultimately wind up playing in the John Wells seasons, of sort of like, there are no actual Republicans quite like Arnie Vinnick. And while there are some Democrats like Bartlett, there are not a lot. And one like him would not have like gotten his party's nomination to become president. So like there are certain fantasy elements and certain ways in which both Sorkin is trying to reach across the aisle, but it's also reflecting the fact that Sorkin is a centrist and, you know, sort of looks at things that way and just sort of seems left compared to what a lot of, you know, pop culture had been for all of our lives until that point. So there's parts of Bartlett that don't feel real, but God, Sheen is so good. Like, to get back to your earlier question, Phil, like when he starts talking about the Cubans coming through a storm with just the clothes on their backs, that still gave me chills. When he says, Mrs. Landingham, what's next? I choked up, although some of that is just knowing what comes with Mrs. Landingham. But he does. I spent a lot of this pilot feeling really frustrated with a show I had once adored. And then Martin Sheen walks in and I'm like, okay, no, I get it. I like the show again. I'm good. I'm here. Yeah.
Emily?
Sheen's performance is titanic. It's ridiculous that he didn't win an Emmy for this. Yeah. Though, you know, the most of the people he lost to, I also like, I don't want to take an Emmy away from you, Michael Chiklis, you know, like it's that sort
Spader
of situation.
Spader can give back an Emmy. Come on.
Okay. Spader can. I forgot Spader was in that run.
Spader got three, I think.
Yeah, did. He beat Gandolfini for, I think, the final season of The Sopranos. Yeah. I do think the Bartlett character, I'll pull back a little bit. Sorkin is a centrist because he can afford to be. He has no skin in the game. His life will not be particularly impacted if fascists take control of the United States. Like, yeah, you know, he might like face some hardship or have trouble getting work or something. But like, you know, the odds of him being put in a situation where it's literally life or death for him are very unlikely. And like, I'm a trans lady, but like I'm an extremely well, you know, not extremely well off, but I'm like, I have a secure job that pays me enough money. I'm a white lady. I live in California. Like I have degrees of privilege above, you know, a poor black trans woman who tend to be the victims of violence in this country, blah, blah, blah. I have a point. I promise. Like the thing about that is I still kind of have to have skin in the game because literally like there are state legislatures throughout the country that are trying to outlaw my existence in like ways that are very pernicious. Aaron Sorkin doesn't have to worry about that. So it's easy for him to be like, well, yeah, what if a Democrat just didn't support abortion rights or was like, you know, sometimes abortions are not right. He's not going to get pregnant. He doesn't ever have to worry about that. Like it's such a fucking fantasy of how the world works. And it's a fantasy that can only be concocted if you have power and privilege. It makes me angrier the further I drift from white manhood. Drift is the wrong word, but you get me.
I do. And listen, I hope that it doesn't seem as though I don't hear where you're coming from. I do. No,
absolutely. I know you do.
I think that this show is idealistic, mm-hmm. and is definitely living in a fantasy. I think that there is comfort in that fantasy, as unfortunately, it might perpetuate problems too. So right. I see that.
I think my larger question is whose idealism is it? Whose fantasy is it? And like, to what degree? Like, it's a fantasy for me too. I want to work in a place where everybody cares about their job passionately and talks quickly and wittily. And like, I enjoy working at a publication where everybody kind of has something interesting to say, and we can like engage in this like really high, this really like interesting banter about like I can learn a lot when I'm talking to my colleagues. But you know. That fantasy of a workplace is so easy to transmute into a fantasy about politics. And it's there where I think the show has huge blind spots.
And a fantasy also where like Mary Marsh is kind of an exception to what the show often did, which is the enemies of Bartlett like disagree with him politically, but they are ultimately well-meaning and noble in some way. Mm-hmm. They are just philosophically opposed to him. She's a rare example of someone who's just an outright opportunist who is, you know, she's going to get whatever she can when she can and, you know, doesn't want to apologize for that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I the political spectrum in this country, notwithstanding, I think that this show is a relic of a time when it felt like there was some crossover between these two parties. I think that it exacerbated any sort of issues that might have exist between these two parties. Obviously, the former president made that abundantly worse, and we are still living with that. But I kind of just want to come back to the religious component in Bartlett for a second, because I do look at someone like Joe Biden, who is openly religious, who is not about indoctrinating people into religion by any stretch of the imagination, but it's important to him. It's helped him through, I'm assuming, hardships. I think it's interesting that, you know, that Aaron Sorkin was, for lack of a better way of putting it, forced into that, because I'm not sure that he would have done it otherwise had Martin Sheen not asked for this to be such a sort of bearing wall for the character. You know, what do you, how do you guys feel about the way that they handle religion within Bartlett's character?
I mean, I think it actually works pretty well. I think it's a good aspect of the character. I think about it a lot like Scully's Catholicism in the X-Files, where it didn't come up that often, but every time it did, it felt organic to the character and it felt important to the character. And I think that works really well for Bartlett. I agree that it is one of the more Bartlett-ish things about Joe Biden, who actually is very similar to Bartlett in a lot of ways, but is taking a sort of very different political tack from what Bartlett would do. Yeah. But like it is an interesting similarity between the two. That said, Barack Obama also had a lot of like very important, like had a religion was very important to him. And a lot of people in the opposition refused to believe that. And I wonder why.
Yeah. Shocking.
Huh, I have no idea.
I have no idea. Yeah. So I want to kind of wrap this up. My hope is to ask my guests each week, because we're not covering the entire series, but I would love to sort of hear of one of your favorite episodes from the series. If it's in season one or otherwise, I'd just be curious to hear sort of what other episodes you might have liked. Alan, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm going to annoy Emily here, and I'm going to be basic, which Emily knows me to do, and I'm going to say Two Cathedrals.
No.
Should I ask why?
No. Because, look, I get it. It's grandiose. It's self-important. It's wildly over the top, and I also haven't watched it again in a number of years. Right. But just the idea of Jed Bartlett standing in the National Cathedral, stubbing out a cigarette and cursing out God in Latin. Like, if you can't do that on this show, like, what are we even doing here? Like, what is the point? That to me is sort of the quintessential good Sorkin scene, or at least the quintessential Sorkin scene to a degree. Emily is going to disagree with me now.
Well, I want to say one quick thing before Emily disagrees, because I think what it also does is it exists on a razor's edge, right? Like, Sorkin is best when he is taking those big swings and he's going for the theatricality of it. But he's also fallen on his face so many times doing that I think the reason Two Cathedrals stands out so well is because he sticks the landing personally, but that's just...
Yeah, I can just never get past the fact that Two Cathedrals is about a crisis that Aaron Sorkin has specifically like created to completely exonerate Jed Bartlett. It's so fake. It's so empty. I'm not going to say anything about Two Cathedrals.
Okay.
If I'm picking an episode I love, I do love In Excelsis Deo. I'm sure if I watched it now, I would find a million things wrong about it. But when I rewatched a lot of this show for a podcast I made at Vox called Primetime, our first episode was about how this show has infected the way we think about politics. And I actually was very nice to the show in that episode because I had other interview subjects who were like, go harder on it. But you know, my feelings have grown stronger with time, let's say. But I specifically did not watch In Excelsis Deo because I knew if I watched it again, I was going to take issue with it. And I just wanted to remember Aaron Sorkin writes the hell out of a Christmas episode.
Yep.
And like, that is such a nice is the wrong word. There's such a compelling, moving, great Christmas episode. And I just wanted to remember it that way. I didn't want to have to sit there and think about all the things that were, you know, wrong with it. So In Excelsis Deo is always the one I say, and please don't like send tweets to me about how Aaron Sorkin calls, like, you know, Aaron Sorkin uses like several racial slurs in it or something.
I don't believe that he does. I mean, I haven't watched In Excelsis that recently.
No, Phil, I got a question for you though. Like, because you're only doing the 1999 episodes.
Correct.
Does Jed's relapsing, remitting multiple sclerosis come up in the 1999 episodes? Do you know? So that's a later thing.
It is not. Okay. It comes up in the premiere of season two.
Okay. No, I think it comes up earlier than that because there's the reason I'm bringing this up because I'm not going to get a chance to tell the story otherwise
please.
You're not hitting the episodes. But Emily brings up the whole this crisis of Sorkin's creation, which is Aaron Sorkin wanted to write a scene where Jed Bartlett watches a daytime soap opera. And he couldn't think of a way to justify it in his head without Bartlett being so ill that, like, he could not work that day. It's not like, oh, we'll just give him the bad flu. No, he has to have a secret, extremely life-threatening condition that he and his doctor wife are unethically keeping hidden from the rest of the nation because that is the only context in which it would be acceptable for me to do the joke about Jed Bartlett complaining about the plot of a soap opera. And, like, look at all of the things that happened on the show as a result of that.
I mean, that's incredible. I know that the story that Sorkin tells is that he doesn't explain why he needed the disease, which I imagine is probably for this explicit reason. But he did say that he went to the staff and said, I want a disease that I can give him that essentially I can manipulate to my needs down the road. However I feel, I want to use it. And he essentially, and to be fair, he did find kind of the perfect disease to do what he wanted to do, which is this relapsing remitting, which is every writer's dream of a disease I can bring back whenever I feel like bringing it back. But I do think that there's something, that the MS thing is interesting as well, because I feel like it's the first time I had seen that as well. A main character sort of, you know, forgive the terminology, but crippled with something, you know, significant, like a massive disease that I felt like, I mean, I know that HIV had been sort of given to characters previously and there were other diseases, but I thought that was an interesting, and I've never seen MS used since, quite honestly, that I can think of.
I'm not sure I have.
No, it is a thing that, like, I mean, I would be interested.
No. What's his face?
You can see Alan, like, going through it in his head. It was amazing.
This is my entire friendship with Alan. It's just him being like, Emily, what's a TV show that stars Big Bird? And I'm like, Sesame Street.
Ray Curto, the captain on The Sopranos, who was the rat for years and years, and everyone always mistook for Patsy Parisi. That's a running gag that anytime Ray Curto is meeting with his FBI handler, he's like, I need more money for interferon for my son's MS. So this was after
not even him, it's his son.
Yes.
This wow. Just David, I mean, Chase, Alan, Duncan on this show. It's just David Chase Duncan on this show. Sure. Perfect.
It does feel like that, right? Do you think that it was like a weird shade thing that he was throwing at the West Wing?
It certainly could be, because I think they introduced that in season 3. So they had been dealing with the whole West Wing problem for a while by then.
That is amazing. Well, you guys are, I don't need to tell you, you guys are incredible. Everyone should be reading all of your stuff and listening to all of your stuff. Alan, do you want to talk about your podcast? And Emily, would you like to talk about your stuff too, please?
So I got a podcast. It's called Too Long Didn't Watch. The premise is that in every episode, I and a celebrity guest sit down. We pick a show they've never seen before. I show them only the pilot and the series finale and nothing in between. And they have to make some sense about it. So we've got like Jon Hamm watching Gossip Girl and Alison Brie watching Game of Thrones and Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally watching My So-Called Life and things like that. And our second season is coming sometime, hopefully soon. And without spoiling the show, Emily is on an episode with me and it is awesome.
Emily, this is not the show that I'm on, but Alan, you and I need to do a recurring thing where I force you to watch Neon Genesis Evangelion because I would love to see what you make. It's only 26 episodes, but I'd love to see what you make of the premiere and the finale of that show watched in a vacuum. My brain lights up with delight thinking
about
it.
This is my entire friendship with Emily is every like 3 weeks she tells me I need to watch Neon Genesis Evangelion. So eventually it'll happen. You'll wear me down.
I do want to say you didn't highlight this episode, but one of my favorite episodes that you did of your podcast, Alan, was Lena Dunham coming on to talk about Cheers.
Oh, that was great.
Tremendous episode. I was currently in the midst of a rewatch of Girls at the time, so it was really lovely to listen to. Emily, please, what about your podcast?
Hi, I am the co-creator of a show called Arden, which is a scripted audio fiction podcast. It is about two women who solve cold cases and try not to fall in love. It's also about a bunch of other stuff, but that's the log line we've come up with. And doesn't it work beautifully? There are two full seasons of it available on your podcatchers of choice. And we just had our first meeting about season three. So you can look forward to that whenever we get around to making it. I also created the Vox podcasts, I Think You're Interesting and Primetime, which you can find. And I'm currently hosting the Vox Quick Hits podcast, What to Watch, where every week Alyssa Wilkins and I tell you something to watch. All of those are also on your podcatcher.
Emily, you work too much. You gotta cut back. You're making the rest of us look bad.
I do. I bought so many video games that I haven't played.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here. I know that we look forward to having you back in the future, either for television or movies or whatever we can pry you away from your other obligations to talk with us about. So I really, really appreciate you both coming on here.
My pleasure.
It was great.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening. It's 1999, podcast like it. You want a podcast like it. 1999.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.